We'll hear arguments first this morning in number 78630, the State of Washington against the Confederated Tribes of the Colville Indian Reservation. Mr. Attorney General, you may proceed whenever you're ready.
Mr. Chief Justice, and may it please the Court. The State of Washington has, for a number of years, imposed a tax of 16 cents per pack on the sale or possession of cigarettes. Income from that tax supports a broad range of state programs, services, and institutions. The state's general sales tax of 5% is also levied against cigarettes. Neither tax is applied to sales by Indians to other Indians on the reservation to which both belong. The respondent tribes recently have gone into the cigarette business. In connection with that business, the tribes levy what they call a tax or an administrative fee on cigarette sales on their reservations. That fee is far smaller than the state's tax. Their claim in this litigation is that their entry into the cigarette business, together with their tax or fee, exempts Washington citizens from the state's cigarette and general sales taxes for on-reservation purchases. A divided district court found that the state's pre-existing tax was preempted by the tribal taxes and fees, and alternatively, that the state tax interfered with tribal self-government. We appealed. The scheme adopted by the tribes, as upheld by the district court, has several interrelated consequences. The tribes emphasize only one of those consequences. Because their taxes or fees are 13 to 16 cents per pack lower than the state's taxes, the tribes sell large quantities of cigarettes to non-Indians who are willing to drive considerable distances to save that differential. As a result, the tribes' revenues are substantial. Not mentioned by the tribes, however, is the fact that the state loses about $4 from its tax revenues for every $1 secured by the tribes. Incidentally, the total loss in state revenues as a result of all Indian smoke shops now is about $13 million per year. Inevitably, that consequence adversely affects the ability of the state to supply governmental and social services to its citizens, Indian and non-Indian alike. The fact that the bulk of that $3 difference between state losses and tribal receipts remains in the pockets of non-Indian purchasers cannot be overemphasized. It illustrates the fact that this case concerns the asserted right of an Indian tribe to market a major tax exemption to non-Indians. Those non-Indians avoid taxes which their fellow citizens who are either more principled or who live farther from reservation smoke shops must pay. The state tax is thus rendered inequitable, and viewed as a revenue-sharing method, the entire system is absurd. In this presentation, I propose first to deal with the preemption issue. I will show that no valid source may be identified to support the claim that the tribes can preempt or that the United States has preempted these state taxes. Then I will demonstrate that the concept of tribal self-government does not and cannot bar the imposition of these same taxes. As an introduction to our argument against preemption, it may help to point out that the word preemption is used in your decisions, as well as in this argument, to describe two closely related but distinct concepts. First, the United States may preempt a state tax by adopting its own comprehensive taxing or regulatory statute, thus occupying the field as it did in the situation in Warren Trading Post. Second, it may also preempt the state without occupying the field, simply by prohibiting the state's entry, as you found it did in the McClanahan situation. Now, except during the heyday of the federal instrumentality doctrine, this court simply has not found a state tax on non-Indians in respect to their on-reservation activities to be preempted unless that preemption is found in a statute or a treaty. And in Mescalero, quite recently, this court declined to revive the federal instrumentality doctrine as a bar even to a state's direct taxation of a tribal enterprise. 80 years ago, in Thomas v. Gay, this court unequivocally held that the Indian Commerce Clause of the Constitution, standing alone, did not preempt state or local taxation of non-Indian property on an Indian reservation. You have consistently required a showing of a preemptive statute or treaty before striking down a state tax on the on-reservation activities of non-Indians. And the only statute you have ever found to have that effect was the Indian Traders Act in the circumstances of the Warren Trading Post case. That statute you found to be so detailed and comprehensive as to preempt Arizona's levy of a gross receipts tax on a non-Indian holding a federal license to trade with the Navajos in respect to his income from Indians on their reservation. Less all-encompassing statutes and treaty provisions, on the other hand, simply do not preempt state taxes on non-Indians doing business on reservations. Almost a century ago, in Utah and Northern Railway Company, when this court could find neither a treaty nor a statutory bar to a territory's taxation of an on-reservation railroad, it upheld the tax. Again, in Thomas versus Gay, you found no treaty or statutory bar to a local tax on non-Indian cattle grazing on the reservation land leased from the tribe with the approval of the Secretary of the Interior, even though the tribal leases were granted under express statutory authority from Congress. And finally, 3 years ago, in Moe, you upheld a state cigarette tax on non-Indian purchasers from an Indian smoke shop. That smoke shop was located on land leased from the tribe. The tribe also controlled the shop's purchases of cigarettes and charged the operator an administrative fee. Nevertheless, you found no treaty or statutory provision to preempt the state tax. To return for a third time to the decision in Thomas v. Gay, the taxpayer asserted there that the tax might destroy the value of the Indian lands for leasing purposes. This court found it sufficient to answer, and this is its complete answer, and I quote, "But it is obvious that a tax put upon the cattle of the lessees is too remote and indirect to be deemed a tax upon the lands or privileges of the Indians," end quote. This is precisely the distinction this court has reaffirmed since the decline of the federal instrumentality doctrine in far broader circumstances. When the legal incidence of a tax is on the United States itself, the tax is invalid. When, however, the legal incidence of a state tax falls on someone else, even though its economic impact is felt by the United States, and even though that it may be alone in that feeling, the tax is valid unless it is expressly preempted by a federal statute. And there are a number of such statutes.
General Gordon, just so I understand this, if the legal instance of this tax had fallen on the retailer, the Indian retailer, it would clearly be invalid.
It would be.
Yeah. Okay.
The tribes here claim a more expansive preemption to apply when a state tax on a private party impacts the income of those tribes than obtains when such a tax impacts the United States government itself. But Mescalero and Moe teach us that no such expansive claim can be supported. Finally, rather than following respondents' invitation to focus on federal statutes which have nothing to do with taxes, like the Indian Financing Act or the Indian Self-Determination Act, we should look briefly at acts which do explicitly address questions of state taxing power over Indians and Indian reservations. Those acts include the Buck Act, Public Law 280, and various termination acts. The first two expressly disclaim any intention to delegate to the states any power to tax Indians on their reservations. The latter, the termination acts, of course, do authorize just such taxes after termination. None of those acts so much as mention any non-Indian immunity from state taxation on their reservation activities. The reason for that is obvious. It never occurred to Congress that there was any such immunity, and Congress was correct. Now, incidentally, the same analysis which applies to the determination of the existence of non-Indian tax immunities on reservation, is there a statute or a treaty creating them, seems also to be the key, at least to your modern determinations, of the validity of state attempts to tax on-reservation Indians themselves. While such cases are decided against the backdrop of the Indian sovereignty doctrine, a statutory or treaty provision always seems to provide the basis for preempting a state tax levied on reservation Indians. In McClanahan, it was the Navajo Treaty and a statutory pattern. In connection with the compensating use tax invalidated in Mescalero, it was a single section of the Indian Reorganization Act. In Moe, state taxes on reservation Indians were preempted only by the statutes cited in McClanahan and Mescalero, and not by any doctrine of constitutional law. Inevitably, therefore, the question here must be what, if any, treaty or statutory source can be found to prevent the state from taxing non-Indians engaged in purchases of cigarettes, which purchases were identical to those in Moe. The statutory pattern here is unchanged from the statutory pattern in that case, and the applicable treaty provisions here, among those who are treaty tribes, are identical in effect to those of the Hellgate Treaty present in the Moe case. Although the tribal participation in the cigarette basis in the Yakima case here adds to the tribal lease arrangements, purchasing controls, and administrative fees present in Moe, only the tribe's wholesaling function in that cigarette business, the tribes claim that a congressional policy of encouraging Indian self-government preempts the state taxes in these cases. The Indian Reorganization Act and subsequent federal enactments cited by respondents in their preemption argument seem to be designed to accomplish twin goals. First, to improve the economic status of individual Indians, and second, to foster tribal self-government. As this court characterized the Indian Reorganization Act in the Mescalero opinion, and I quote you, "These provisions were designed to encourage tribal enterprises to enter the white world on a footing of equal competition," end quote. Now, Moe tells us that no federal statute or treaty gives an individual Indian a huge competitive advantage in the cigarette business by preempting a state tax levied on non-Indians. Thomas V. Gay, Mescalero, and Moe teach us that the mere fact that a non-Indian tax may adversely impact tribal income does not trigger an automatic preemption of that state tax. How then can a tribal entry into the cigarette business, with or without a tribal tax, trigger a preemption which gives the tribe a prohibitive competitive advantage in the teeth of the federal goal to encourage tribal enterprises to enter the non-Indian business world on a footing of equal competition?
General Gordon, is the extent of the competitive advantage significant in your argument? Now, there's apparently both an excise tax and a sales tax. Is the same argument applicable to both?
The same argument is applicable to both.
So the extent of the competitive advantage really isn't critical to your argument?
No, no. The policy of these acts are that Indians should enter the non-Indian business world on an equal footing basis.
And does your argument apply to retail sales by Indians of things they might make on the reservation, artifacts or one thing or another, souvenirs and things like that?
To non-Indians.
Same.
And as a matter of fact, that kind of tax was even upheld by the district court in this case.
Right.
The answer is that the tribe cannot trigger such a preemption. Since no federal statute has been cited for the proposition that tribal enterprises are entitled to unequal advantages over their non-Indian competitors, the state's non-discriminatory taxes on non-Indian purchasers of cigarettes from Indian dealers are not preempted.
Mr. Attorney General, you answered Brother Stevens that if the incidence of the tax was on the Indian seller, there would be it would be illegal or unconstitutional or what? What's the basis for that? Is it preemption?
The basis for that would be McClanahan.
Yeah, well,
Escalera. It would be. I believe it would.
Do you understand the?
It would be preemption.
From what?
Preemption from the statutory and treaty pattern, which was utilized in McClanahan and then later in Mull, to preempt exactly
you
this
don't
kind
think,
of state tax.
You don't. Would this be a wrong statement that absent some federal statute expressly permitting such a tax, it is forbidden? Is that a brand of preemption? It might be.
I think that the correct statement would be, based on Mull and expressly on footnote 17 of Mull, that absent a federal statute or treaty provision preventing or prohibiting such a tax, the state would be permitted to impose it even on sales to Indians.
You suggest that it's preempted by a pattern of federal statutes and treaties.
It is precisely the pattern which was utilized in McClanahan
preemption in the sense of conflict or just occupying the field, I suppose.
In McClanahan, it would be a prohibition because there was no attempt, there was no occupation of the field elsewhere, nor was there in Mull. There were no Indian taxes which interfered in the state's attempt to impose the tax in either McClanahan or Mull on Indians.
So you think it's an expression of congressional consent that in the light of these, congressional intent that in light of the existing statutes, there shouldn't be any state tax?
That's correct. The tribes in the United States assert that even if there is no preemption of the state's power to tax on-reservation cigarette purchases by non-Indians, nevertheless, the state tax may not be imposed because it infringes upon the right of reservation Indians to make their own laws and be governed by them. And it states that as a separate theory. That right of Indian self-government, standing alone without preemption, can never bar the imposition of a tax by the state on its own non-Indian citizens. In illustration, the broadest powers of self-government which can be possessed by any sovereign are those exercised by a fully sovereign nation, obviously. But the United States itself, obviously a self-governing sovereign, has no power to prevent Great Britain from imposing taxes on British citizens on purchases made by those citizens on visits here to the United States, even if the goods purchased here never leave the United States. Another illustration.
But Mr. General Gordon, I suppose the parallel would be, could Great Britain require the United States retailer to keep a lot of records and do the regulating necessary?
No, it could not, because the United States retailer is not within Great Britain.
That's really the problem here, because there's no doubt about your power to impose the tax. You can impose the tax if they buy it over in Oregon, too, can't you?
We can impose a different tax. We can impose a tax when they return it to the state of, when they return with those goods to the state of Washington. We could not impose a tax if they never did so. But the point is here that...
Couldn't you impose the tax?
Point is,
maybe you couldn't collect it, but you could impose it. If your British analogy is a good one anyway.
My British analogy would not cover this situation because the United States Constitution would prevent the state of Washington from making that imposition. That's why I used the British example. The United States Constitution does not bar the British tax collector in dealing with his own citizens. The point here is, however, Mr. Justice Stevens, that this injunction and the theory of the case by the United States and the tribes doesn't say that we simply can't collect this tax on the reservation, but can collect it from non-Indians who leave the reservation. It says that the tax is invalid. We may not impose it at all, even after non-Indian citizens return. And of course, that's necessary to their argument, because in order to protect their tribal income, they need to prevent us from imposing that tax anywhere, not simply from collecting it on the reservation itself.
General Gordon, would the reasoning of the majority
allow an Indian automobile franchise on the reservation to sell new automobiles and prevent the state of Washington from collecting a use tax if those automobiles were used outside of the reservation but in the state of Washington.
If the automobile dealership were a tribal enterprise producing income for the tribe, the theory of the district court would prevent that tax. And I intend to get to that in a little bit greater detail in just a moment. Another illustration similar to the British one. The Yakima Nation was fully sovereign early in the 19th century. Nevertheless, it could not then have exercised that unlimited power of self-government to prohibit the United States from taxing one of its citizen members of the Lewis and Clark expedition on purchases which that citizen made from Yakima Indians in the Yakima Nation. The Constitution or laws of the United States might have prohibited such a tax, but the laws of the Yakima Nation could not have done so. The power to levy a tax may be inherent in retained sovereignty, but the power to bar the imposition of a tax by another sovereignty on its own citizens in its own territory is not. Thus, the limited right of self-government now possessed by the Indian tribes cannot bar Washington's imposition of these cigarette taxes on non-Indians in Washington state. The United States may, in the future, preempt these taxes by some statute, or even authorize the tribe to do so. But to assert a right of tribal self-government is not to present an alternative ground for affirming the district court. It is merely to restate the preemption argument. Nothing in this submission, of course, is designed to deny the reality of the tribal self-government doctrine, and the proposition that state action may not infringe on the right of reservation Indians to make their own laws and to be ruled by them. That Williams v. Lee doctrine does two things. Affirmatively, it confirms in the tribes the right to control internal tribal relations, to prescribe laws applicable to tribal members, and to enforce those laws in its own courts. Negatively, it prohibits the state from applying its laws to on-reservation Indians and enforcing those laws in state courts except where authorized by Congress to do so. This protection necessarily requires non-Indians to sue reservation Indians in tribal courts in order to enforce rights created on the reservation. A state tax on non-Indians cannot possibly affect that right of reservation Indians to make their own laws and to be governed by them. This court has never extended that doctrine to bar a state tax on non-Indians. Nor should it do so now. To do so would be to subvert the very foundations of state sovereignty and the ability of the state to adopt a just and equitable tax system. If the state of Washington may not impose its cigarette taxes on reservation sales to non-Indians, because to do so would interfere with tribal self-government, by destroying a source of tribal revenue, can the state then even repeal its tax on off-reservation sales in order to equalize tax burdens on its citizens? That action would have exactly the same effect on tribal cigarette sales and tribal income as would the imposition of the state's tax on the reservation. Of course, the state retains the right, the power, to repeal its off-reservation tax. The question and answer simply illustrate the point that the effect on tribal revenues of a state tax on non-Indians is as irrelevant to the right of tribal self-government today as it was at the time of Thomas v. Gay. The state of Washington has chosen, rationally, to levy high excise taxes on tobacco and liquor, among other things, either to discourage their consumption or to concentrate its revenue sources on socially marginal activities rather than on important activities such as the purchase of food. That choice and similar future choices are threatened by the decision below. Our state might well choose in the future to impose extremely high excise taxes on, say, the purchase of gold or of motor vehicles which make less than 20 miles per gallon of gas. Should the district court be affirmed, however, the sale of those goods, if the tax were high enough, could immediately be monopolized by Indian tribes by the simple expedient of adopting tribal ordinances similar to those at issues here.
Well, would it make any difference to your argument if the state of Washington had adopted a tax of a dollar a loaf on bread and the Indian tribes on their lands sold bread tax-free?
It would not make any theoretical difference in the argument, Mr. Justice Rehnquist, remembering, of course, that the Indians could sell it tax-free to their own members. But that tax might very well be found to be unconstitutional or some kind of violation of due process. But the nature of the tax...
What tax? I'm talking about a tax on sales. Supposing instead of smoke shops on the reservations, the Indians had bread shops.
If the set of statutory patterns and tribal ordinances were identical to those here, the result would be the same.
Furniture shops or
interestingly enough, in the case of furniture shops, the district court here found the state tax to apply because the Indians had not shown that it had any effect on their income. In effect, the power to decide how Washington citizens will be taxed and what social goals are to be pursued will be transferred from the state legislature to the tribal councils. We submit that neither the Constitution, nor any act of Congress, nor any treaty provision, nor the right of tribal self-government permits such a subversion of rational state policies and non-discriminatory taxes on non-Indians. The right of Indian self-government and the right of all citizens to self-government can flourish together only if these decisions are reversed. There is, however, a shorter and similar and simpler answer to this controversy if this court wishes to adopt it. Simply follow your own decision in Moe. The transactions here do not differ significantly from those in Moe. In the Yakima case here, the tribe does not claim to be engaged in the retail cigarette business, nor does it claim to tax cigarette sales to non-Indians. It is solely a cigarette wholesaler whose profit is partly called by that name and partly denominated an administrative fee. The tribe in Mole imposed just such an administrative fee, leased the smoke shop site, and controlled wholesale purchases. In the Colville case here, the tribes do claim to be in the retail cigarette business and to levy a retail tax on cigarettes. But the actual conduct of that business does not differ from that of the Yakimas. The tribe is really a wholesaler profiting from two different markups, one of which it calls a tax. The smoke shop operator is much like the operator in Moe. He pays a fixed price per carton to the tribe, sets whatever retail price he wishes, and takes home his gross sales receipts less his costs and business expenses. The state's taxes on non-Indian purchasers and its collection requirements on Indian retailers operate in precisely the same fashion and with precisely the same results as did the Montana tax in Moe. The result here should be the same as well.
Mr. Anderson.
Mr. Chief Justice, may it please the Court. The state of Washington in these proceedings contends for a radical principle, the principle that it has the power to effectively preempt and eliminate tribal taxation of Indian commerce on trust land within the exterior boundaries of an Indian reservation. Under the facts of this case, that commerce is already taxed by the tribe, the governing body of the situs where this Indian commerce between Indians and non-Indians takes place. And our contention is that the state's attempt to apply its tax laws is an attempt to appropriate to itself tax revenues, which more properly belong to the Indian tribe which is the governing body of the situs of this commerce. Although Mr. Gorton tries to tell this court that this is a tax immunity case, that is not so. This is not Mo. This is a case in which the tribe is levying its own tax and using those tax revenues for essential governmental purposes.
Are you addressing yourself now exclusively to the cigarette tax, or broader, more broadly than that?
I am addressing right now the cigarette tax, Mr. Chief Justice. There was no contention by the tribes in our case regarding the sales tax, and that is not an issue in the Caldwell case. The real issue...
You represent the three tribes other than the Yakima Nation.
That's correct, Your Honor. The real issue in this case is which of two inconsistent and incompatible tax laws can be applied to these reservation transactions when it is not possible for the two systems to peacefully coexist. The stipulated facts in this case make it absolutely clear that there can be no survival of the tribal taxing systems if the state tax is superimposed upon the tribal tax that is already levied on these goods. If the state succeeds...
You mean that's because it's economically not feasible?
Yes. I'm talking about the practicalities of the situation, and I think this Williams versus Lee is a practical test, and I think the imposition of state law in this case ought to be judged by its practical effects. It is clear that this protected commerce between Indian and non-Indians, constitutionally protected commerce, if the state imposes its tax, will be subjected to multiple burdens.
You're not claiming that the basis for your exemption here is constitutional, are you?
We make that argument as well, Your Honor, yes.
In spite of the footnote 17 in Moe?
Footnote in 17 in Moe, Justice Rehnquist, stated that, was talking about the issue in McClanahan, whether or not state tax laws could be applied to Indians on the reservation, and the court said that its McClanahan decision made it clear that there was no automatic exemption, and that is of course clear because in McClanahan the court looked to the specific federal statutes rather than the United States Constitution to find the preemption. But the issue of a tax that directly and substantially interferes with tribal self-government was not presented in McClanahan. And I do not read that footnote in Moe to have disposed of the constitutional issues that were not before it. We do contend that one of the purposes of the Indian Commerce Clause was to provide protection for tribal self-government. And a tax, Williams versus Lee, after all, is in part a constitutional test. You will remember that the court in Williams said that the question was whether absent governing laws of Congress, state law would impermissibly interfere with tribal self-government. And this court in Williams also recognized that the holding of the United States Supreme Court in Worcester was also a constitutional holding.
But didn't McClanahan make the statement that we had moved from an era of automatic lines between constitutional and unconstitutional to a less sovereign and more preemptive type of test?
McClanahan did say, Your Honor, that the Indian sovereignty doctrine was the backdrop and not the dispositive principle. But I think what the court was saying was that the Worcester principle, originally announced by Justice Marshall, had been somewhat modified. Originally, as the opinion in Worcester makes clear, the court treated Indian reservations that time as a virtual island, a boundary in which state law could not cross under any circumstances. And in McClanahan, the court noted that in situations where tribal governments were not affected and the rights of Indians were not affected, state law could be applied to non-Indians. But on the other hand, the court in Williams made clear, and as well in McClanahan, that the basic holding of Worcester, the basic constitutional holding, still remained intact in situations where essential governmental relations, essential tribal relations were involved. And I don't think that the Moe footnote can or should be read to eliminate a line of constitutional argument that was not even at issue in the court before the court in Moe. Now, it is clear that the practical impact of the imposition of this state tax will be to totally destroy the tribe's ability to tax in this situation. The district court specifically found that one of the results of imposition of state taxes will be the elimination of essential tax revenues needed by these tribal programs, for the financing of these tribal programs. In addition, the court found that a result of the imposition of these taxes would be forced relinquishment of these critically needed tribal programs. Now, ultimately, the principle that the state contends for here is that an Indian tribe would have no ability whatsoever to tax transactions on the reservation that are already being taxed by the state. By the same token, an Indian tribe, if the state's principle is granted, would be committing economic suicide if it also attempts to tax transactions in which there is no state tax. In either case, the result of imposing the state tax would be to hold that Indian commerce and transactions on the reservation would be more expensive than those transactions off the reservation. Now, Indian tribes are already suffering from depressed economies. Our tribes are geographically isolated. It's difficult for them, difficult enough for them to rehabilitate themselves and provide essential services with these physical and geographical disabilities. Now, the state of Washington would impose additional disabilities upon the state by effectively preempting its ability to tax.
What about the furniture store or the automobile dealership?
I think the district court answered that argument very well. The state of Washington, in the proceedings below, tried to argue that there was no limit to this principle, that if the tribes could tax cigarettes, they would extend their activities to all sorts of other situations. The district court found, and this is essential to its holding, that the tribes had acted in a restrained manner, and the situation of a tribe attempting to extend its laws to all sorts of other situations is simply not before the court.
Well, what theoretical principle separates a furniture store or an automobile dealership on the one hand from a smoke shop on the other?
Well, there perhaps is no absolute theoretical difference, but
is there any theoretical difference?
Well, it seems to me that a core of the district court's holding was that the tribes were acting in a limited capacity. In a limited way, they were acting with restraint. Each of the tribes has imposed a three-carton limitation in this case. It is designed, each of our three client tribes, that is designed to prevent an extreme loss of tax revenues by the tribe. The tribes have acted with restraint, and there's just simply no occasion for this court to consider now a tribe trying to extend its activities into all sorts of other areas.
Well, what about there are extensions in some other reservations, aren't there, around the country or not?
There are other tribes that are taxing alcohol sales. I'm not aware.
What
of
about
any
ski
other
areas?
I believe the Mescalero Apache tribe
that was off reservation.
That was.
How about in some other areas? So
I'm not aware of other tax systems. I think some of the tribes may have taxed minerals on the reservation.
How about hotels?
I'm not aware of. Well, there are several tribes that have established resorts on the reservation.
Mm-hmm.
I'm not aware of whether any taxes are imposed.
But you would make the same argument. Well, if the tribes tax those, you would make the same argument, I suppose.
The same arguments could be made. But I would like to remind the court that because of the physical isolation of these tribes, there are very practical limitations on the tribe's ability to raise revenues in this manner. I would also...
Aren't those limitations, wouldn't they be affected by the number of cartons you permitted them to purchase? And if you win this case, why couldn't the tribe say, well, instead of a 3-carton limit, we'll have a 10-carton limit?
The district court advised us, I think, in its opinion, that one of the reasons that this tax was sustained was that it was limited, and the tribes were acting responsibly, and the tribes were not attempting to take an unfair or excessive share of state tax revenues. The fact that the tribes are limited, I think, is essential to
the... I have the same problem Mr. Justice Rehnquist expressed about why is that legally significant?
Well, let me respond to that in this way. Justice Frankfurter, in his opinion in New York versus United States, said this: to press a juristic principle designed for the practical affairs of government to abstract extremes is neither sound logic nor good sense. And this court is under no duty to make law less than sound logic and good sense.
He was joined by one other justice in that opinion, wasn't he?
Well, there were a number of separate opinions written by the court. But I think that is the point I want to make is Justice Frankfurter's observation is a sound one. The imposition of state taxes in this case ought to be judged by what the tribes are doing, what limitations are imposed by the tribes.
Well, as a practical matter, if you can get so many people to come to buy three cigarettes, couldn't you get an awful lot more to come to buy a new Chevrolet if it's tax-free?
Well, one of the problems with that kind of program is that in order for this scheme, for this tribal enterprise to work, we have to be dealing with an area in which the state taxation is substantial. It's not practical, perhaps, for tribes to enter the sales tax area where the differential wouldn't be great enough to cause people to travel long distances to the reservation.
Well, doesn't the state of Washington levy a sales tax on new cars?
It does, yes.
Well, what if the tribe levied exactly the same tax?
If the tribe levied the same tax
as... What if there was a dealership on the reservation and the tribe levied an equal tax on the sales of new cars to non-Indians?
On sales of new cars to non-Indians?
Mm-hmm.
Well, the state of... The principle that that a tribe, when it exercises its taxing power, can preempt inconsistent state law would apply.
That's all Justice Rehnquist has been asking, isn't it? Same principle would apply if you had a tribal tax on sales of new cars.
Yes, except that it is not necessary for this court, in deciding this case, to consider extensions of this doctrine to their ultimate and perhaps illogical conclusion. It's well within the power of this court to set any limits that may be necessary or appropriate. I would also emphasize
that this may not apply to new cars.
If this court says that it cannot be applied beyond the facts of this case to another situation. The district court basically did that by cautioning the tribes that its holding was based on the fact that the tribes were acting in an extremely limited manner in this case. And I think the district court gave us a warning in that instance.
I don't understand why you characterize the economic situation in saving $200 or $300 on the sales tax on an automobile as an illogical conclusion. It seems to me it's a perfectly logical conclusion, and your argument should apply equally there.
I don't believe I said it was an illogical conclusion. I said it's not necessary for this court to decide cases which are not before it. Let's emphasize one other point. The state of Washington is attempting to...
Couldn't we say the case before us is the taxing of commodities?
The issue before us is taxing commodities that are involved in commerce between Indians and non-Indians,
right.
Yes.
So that would include tires, batteries?
All channels.
Those are...
Yes or no?
Yes, I would think so.
All of that's before us?
Yes. Theoretically.
But yet you say the only thing we can decide is the tobacco. We can decide that the Indians can tax all commodities.
I don't think it's necessary for this court to say that.
I'm trying to find out what you are saying.
I'm trying to say that the principle before this court is a limited one, and I think that it must be considered in context because
all commodities you consider to be limited.
Well, the
all A double L.
The tribe is...
There's nothing in all that's limited.
Perhaps I don't understand your question.
You say unlimited, and you admitted it, you said the Danes can tax all commodities.
I said that the tribe has extended its taxing ordinance in a limited way in this case, and if the tribe exercised its power to seriously interfere with state government or some such thing, facts which are not now before this court, this court might well be in a position to draft a holding that would prevent that kind of abuse, if it was regarded so, of tribal power. That issue is not before the court now.
Your time has expired now, Mr. Anderson. Mr. Hovis.
Mr. Chief Justice, and may it please the court. I represent the Yakima Indian Nation appellee in the United States versus Washington case. We do not take the position that this principle that we are asking for here should be limited just to cigarettes. I see no logical difference between any goods, whether cigarettes, cars, furniture, etc. It would appear to me, in the principle position we take, that if the state requires relief in regards to sales of other items that do not fit in with the Indian economy and do exceed their sovereign bounds, that the remedy that the state of Washington would have would be a legislative one before Congress. My colleague, Mr. Anderson, has really put the bulk of his discussion in regards to this matter on the Williams preemption infringement test. It has been pointed out that, and it is stipulated and agreed by everyone in this case, that if the state tax goes on, that it will destroy these federally approved tribal and tribally licensed enterprise. I think it must be pointed out that in each tribe, as the federal government through the responsible federal authority have had these enterprises approved by the federal government. And I would join my colleague in submitting that Washington's scheme is in violation of the Williams infringement preemption test, and that the district court's holdings are correct. But I would, if the court please, like to take my portion of the time to talk about Washington's jurisdiction and power to reach these transactions on Indian reservations, on trust lands where the state has no jurisdiction or power, regardless of whether or not this would impair the tribal government or impair the tribal enterprise, or regardless of whether or not it would destroy it.
Then regardless of whether there's an Indian tax?
Regardless of whether there's an Indian tax. Mm-hmm. If I could take that. I think General Gorton...
This isn't a request to re-argue Montana.
No, sir. No, sir. I would like to distinguish Montana later. General Gorton, as I see it, in his attempt, in the state of Washington's attempt to destroy tribal self-government, has two circles or two perimeters he must pierce. The first one is what I call the McClanahan principle, or what this court has called the McClanahan principle, and the second one is the Williams infringement test, is a second perimeter he must pierce before he can destroy tribal self-government. And I submit that in this case, that the state of Washington has no jurisdiction or power to tax this sale between the Indians and non-Indians on trust lands within the Yakima Indian Reservation. I think this court has pointed this way to me in its 1973 per curiam decision in the Tenasket versus Washington, when the Washington tax system was last before this court. And at that time, they said they reversed the Washington tax scheme, saying, we reverse and send it back your Supreme Court decision. We ask you to look first at the state law and second at the McClanahan case. And when the Supreme Court then of the state of Washington then dealt with it, they said that under state law that the tax did not apply, and therefore reversed their original decision, but not based on the McClanahan principle, because they took care of it underneath state law and it did not arrive. In McClanahan, this court determined that Arizona had exceeded its power when it attempted to apply Arizona's individual income tax to a reservation Indian, regardless of whether or not this action infringed on the tribal government. This court has said in Bryan versus Itasca County that the McClanahan principle provides that state laws are not applicable to tribal Indians on an Indian reservation, except where Congress has expressly provided that state laws shall apply. My learned friend General Gorton relies on this court's holding in Mole versus Salish and Kootenai tribes and submits that the McClanahan principle is not applicable to this instant case. I would like to discuss the reason that I believe and submit the reason that I believe that Mole is not applicable here. In Mole, what this court did, as I read the decision, was to uphold the district court's denial of a restraint of criminal arrest of Indian retailers selling unstamped cigarettes to non-Indians contrary to the state criminal code on the Flathead Head Reservation, where Congress had expressly authorized state criminal jurisdiction. Moe did not involve the collection of taxes from Indian retailers. It did not involve the state licensing or the state regulation of Indian retailers. While here, this case involves the collection of the taxes if the Indians do not collect them from the non-Indian purchasers, the collecting the taxes from the Indian purchasers, and also provides for the state regulation of the retailers to provide with the state regulations in regards to this. My friend General Gorton suggests that it has the power to collect these taxes, and we believe that is not correct, because on the where these transactions took place on the Yakima Reservation were within the exterior boundaries of the Yakima Reservation and on trust lands where there is no jurisdiction. The state has no criminal or civil jurisdiction over the Indians involved on these lands. This court in Washington versus Yakima Nation last term upheld that this was part of the state's purpose to provide for state government to keep the jurisdiction off of that, and held that Congress had that in mind, expressly had that in mind, when it passed Public Law 280, that such a partial holding of jurisdiction could be provided. Now, the transaction which Washington claims, taxing powers, all took place on these lands, and there was no jurisdiction over the tribal members at all for any regulatory power, arrest power, or civil or criminal, judicial or legislative power over the Indians involved. And as this court said in McClanahan, unless the states can show how they can constitutionally impose the collection of this tax and the regulation on the Indians where they have no jurisdiction, legislative or judicial, then that disposes of the case. And that's pages 178 and 179 of that decision. Now, Washington, my friend General Gorton, submits that Washington, in his briefs, may seize without process, due or otherwise, goods being delivered to my client in interstate commerce to trust lands. Now, these goods that are being delivered to my client, the Yakima Nation, are not taxable in any event, because it's clear that these goods are sold to Indians on Indian within the reservation, sold to Indians on the Indian reservation on trust lands. The Yakima Nation does not sell to non-Indians. The non-Indian retailers later sell to non-Indians, but when these goods are in transit, they're not being sent to the Yakima Indian Reservation in interstate commerce by bonded carriers. The sale that the Yakima Nation makes is a legal one to its licensed retailers.
Is this issue before the court, the issue of the sealed trucks that go through Washington to the reservation? I thought the district court just didn't reach it because it struck down the tax.
It struck down the tax situation on the preemption and infringement test, on the Williams test, and it didn't reach that. But I'm suggesting for a full discussion of this problem before the court, because this court has, not this case, but it has some similar cases that it has accepted jurisdiction on, that some discussion of the McClanahan principle would be applicable here today in your determination. And I'm into the enforcement area here to show you that there is no due process, or submit to you that there is no due process way that the state of Washington can collect its tax or have any power, legislative or judiciary, over the Indian retailers, which they suggest that they're trying to do.
Well, what if the state of Washington simply stated the station tax collectors on the Washington side of the boundary between the reservation and the state of Washington, and inspected cars coming off the reservation, and if they bought cartons of cigarettes on the reservation, they would impose a use tax on them?
I would think, Your Honor, that we are not in any different, nor do I claim that we are any different from the state of Oregon. If you purchase something in Oregon, in providing that you comply with the Constitutional Commerce Clause, if the state of Washington does that and is not discriminatory, then they can collect from their non-Indians when they're within their jurisdiction.
Do you think your colleague from the Three Tribes agrees with you?
No, they do not.
And nor the United States.
Well, I have not asked the United States. But they do not take the same position in this case that I do, Justice White.
No. And would you say that since you emphasize enforcement, if the state could collect at the boundaries of the reservation, may they make the Indian seller collect?
No, they may not. They have no jurisdiction, legislative or judicial, over the Indian seller. That's my point. And I can go further, however. I do not disagree totally with my colleague, Mr. Anderson. I do not disagree totally with him, but I don't think it's as clear as this principle. I think there is a situation here where this sale may not be able to reach with a use tax outside the exterior boundaries. And let me explain to you why I do not disagree with Mr. Anderson, although I do not think it is as clear as this principle. The reason I do not disagree with him is because this is not a case in which Congress has been silent. This is not a case in which Congress has been silent. Congress has, in passing the Buck Act, said this: it permits the state to levy sales, use, or income taxes in a federal area, but it expressly provides that nothing therein shall be deemed to authorize the collection of any tax on or from any Indian not taxed. And as pointed out in our cases in the brief, this is a continuance of an existing thing. Now, I was particularly interested in the decision written by Justice Donaldson for the Mahoney majority in the Idaho Supreme Court. And I adopt his understanding, and I adopt his rationale. As he pointed out, that Congress must have been aware at the time it passed that Buck Act in Section 109 of the existing solicitor's opinions of the United States that opine that Indians are not subject to state laws, whether they deal with Indians or non-Indians, and in the tax field. Now, that Mahoney decision is a late one. That's the circumstance we have surrounding us. Idaho, underneath their state law, does not tax, does not try to impress the situation. I think it's worth noting that with the regularity that this court sees Mr. Gorton, that the state of Washington has somewhat different attitude about Indian rights than some of our neighboring states. But one of the things, Justice Rehnquist, in your question, you were talking a little bit about some of the discussion of McClanahan. And yes, there has been some change from the Worcester Doctrine, some modification into line of more preemption. But one of the problems, because you see in, in Worcester was a non-Indian. Worcester was a non-Indian underneath the Worcester Doctrine. And
your time has expired now, Mr. Hovis. Mr. Claiborne.
Mr. Chief Justice, may it please the Court. Perhaps before attempting to join them back together, it might be useful if I sought to unravel the several strands of the argument as we see it on this side. Without pretending that any single one of these arguments is sufficient to carry the day, it is, in our submission, useful to look at three arguments that, when joined, do, in our submission, justify the holding of the district court. I identify them first as the territorial principle, secondly as the commercial principle, and thirdly as the governmental principle, somewhat arbitrary titles for the purpose. But the territorial idea is one which, of course, dates from the very earliest cases in this court dealing with Indian tribes. It is basically the notion that only in exceptional circumstances, as this court repeated only last term, may state law or state taxes invade that area which has been reserved to the continuing sovereignty of the tribe, albeit in a most limited way. And the question, therefore, is whether this case, this tax, or these taxes fall within that exception, not the other way round. The burden is not on the tribe to show that this particular tax would normally apply, but for reasons A, B, and C, it does not. The burden is very much on the state to justify the intrusion of its law, of its tax, within an area still separate in some meaningful sense. Now, that principle is not only an old one, it's one which has been reiterated as recently as Wheeler. It is a principle which has been the basis for distinguishing between activities on and off reservation, including cases in the tax area. Noticeably, the Mescalero opinion in 411 U.S. reports. I suggest that the result in that case, in respect of the sales tax or gross profits tax, would have been different had that ski enterprise been on rather than off the reservation. And the thrust of the opinion, as I read it, is the emphasis on the fact that the immunity has its limits, its geographic limits, and cannot be imported beyond the limits of the reservation, or exported. And of course, there's no attempt to do so in this case. There is, of course, a giving way of reservation boundaries over the years with the opening up policy, which results in non-Indians living on the reservation. But that historic fact has nothing to do with this case. We're not dealing with a modern change of fact which requires a change of law because the Yakima Reservation is inhabited by a substantial non-Indian population. We're dealing with Indian trade, which has been going on since the beginning, in which the white man sells to the Indian and vice versa. Instead of dealing with furs or with other skins or with horses, or with tobacco in its raw form, we now deal with cigarettes. But the principle ought to be the same. Of course, it matters what the effect of the state's intrusion is. If its law, if its tax, impinges only on the non-Indian residents or the non-Indian while on the reservation, that is permissible. That is not the situation here. The effect is not indirect, it's not remote, it's not minimal. It destroys a tribal enterprise, and it's a tribal enterprise and not a private one. With those remarks, I turn to the second aspect, which is the burden which this state tax places on Indian commerce. simply to illustrate that there is such a principle, and indeed a constitutional principle, which derives directly from the Indian Commerce Clause, one need only posit a state law which prohibited the importation, if I may use that word, into the state of Washington of products grown or manufactured on the Yakima Reservation. Such a law would be manifestly unconstitutional as violating the Indian Commerce Clause. And so would the reverse, a prohibition on the exportation of products into an Indian reservation. Now, of course, that's not this case, but it simply illustrates that the Indian Commerce Clause has, like the other aspects of the Commerce Clause, a self-executing force which may be relevant to this case. Here we deal with state taxes which not only burden the commerce between Indian and non-Indian, but which, in this respect, destroy it utterly. The district court found that the state sales taxes, as applied to furniture and other manufacture, did not have that effect, that the effect was not demonstrated and presumptively minimal, and accordingly did not invalidate those taxes. Here, the combined effect of the state excise and sales tax on cigarettes admittedly destroys that commerce. That effect, it seems to us, implicates the Indian Commerce Clause. Now, finally, and perhaps most importantly, we look at the governmental aspect of the case, and here the great distinction between this case and Moe.
So you would say that because collection at the border of the reservation from the buyer would have the same impact, the tax collected that way would be too burdensome.
Mr. Justice White, if forced to an answer, I think I probably would say that. I would stress that this is not a use tax imposed only on the use of the cigarettes once they've left the reservation.
The Washington law is that we impose on the buyer a tax when he buys cigarettes, and they just collect it from him at the border.
Mr. Justice White, I appreciate the hypothetical, but it is a hypothetical. It isn't this case. In this case, the tax
That's a fine answer.
I thought I'd said, Mr. Justice White, that if compelled to an answer, but emphasizing the difference between your hypothetical and the case before the court, I would argue that they both fall because of the effect on not merely the commerce,
but I suppose the state could repeal its own sales tax.
Yes, I have no quarrel with that.
Even just on cigarettes.
I recognize that that is so, and that too might have the same effect. Many things may have the same effect without being equally subject to challenge.
What if the Indians went into the business of manufacturing automobiles and made automobiles which they sold to the public, didn't tax them at all? The state of Washington imposed its excise tax on them. Would you say that the fact that the state of Washington's excise tax was enough to ruin the margin of profit that the Indians had been making before it imposed the tax fall, even though collected as a use tax outside the reservation?
In that instance, and I'm not clear, Mr. Justice Rehnquist, whether the enterprise of manufacturing the cars in your hypothetical is done by the tribe
or by some
entrepreneur. There is perhaps an important difference there, but that case seems to me would fall on the other side of the line, that is, that we could not invalidate Washington's tax in those circumstances, there being no collision between the tax imposed by the tribe, there being none in your hypothetical, and that imposed by the state. There are gradations, but if you look at it from the other extreme, it seems absurd, perhaps, that Washington would claim its right to tax even the most traditional Indian artifacts produced on the reservation, which would not otherwise come into commerce at all. And yet the Attorney General was quite clear that he would apply the same rule to that situation. It may be that the tribes, though every incentive leads them to self-restraint, after all, they must live, at the end of the day, with the state, with state officials. In Washington, state law, for the most part, applies on their reservations. There must be a modus vivendi. It is not in their interest to press their advantage if it's legally recognized to the extreme. But should they unwisely attempt to do so, the remedy in my submission lies with Congress. And Congress would undoubtedly be quickly receptive to any indication that the tribes were abusing their privilege in such a way as seriously to detract from important state revenues. That is not the case here. Indeed, many other states have taken the opposite view of these reservation smoke shop operations. We're told by amici in this case that Nevada, that Florida expressly condone the claim of the tribes to be exempted from sales and excise taxes on their sales of cigarettes to non-Indians. The Idaho Supreme Court has so held. I'm further informed that Arizona takes the same view. Indeed, so do Wisconsin and New Mexico. That is the pattern. Washington is the exception. It apparently is a system with which most of the states have been content to live, and some have expressly recognized that this small effort by the tribes to become self-sustaining is lawful, ought not be interfered with.
You have solid statistical basis for saying one is the pattern and the other is the exception.
Mr. Justice Rehnquist, I can't say that there's been sufficiently accurate or adequate investigation of the various state laws. This information is for the most part contained in briefs filed, in this case, amicus curiae. I have supplemented it insofar as I've mentioned New Mexico, Wisconsin, and Arizona.
With respect to some of the states that don't attempt to collect its own tax, it doesn't make any difference whether there's a tribal tax or not. Isn't that true?
I'm not suggesting, Mr. Justice White, if I've misled the court, that in each of these cases there is a tribal tax, but that there is a tribal cigarette business, and that in each of these states, the state, though imposing an excise tax generally, does not impose that tax on sales to non-Indians occurring within a reservation.
You don't suggest that without the tax, the Washington would be out of bounds here, without the tribal tax.
I suggest that it would be on a very close boundary.
Would it be covered by Moore or not?
It would. There is another distinction between that case, between this case and Moe, which is that here we're dealing with a governmental operation, not only in the sense that the tribe taxes, but that the tribe regulates everything,
Yakima?
Including price.
How about the Yakima Nation?
That is so, the Yakima Nation.
Well, is that a tribal enterprise?
It's a tribal wholesale enterprise. Mm-hmm. The ordinance requires that a uniform price be fixed by the dealers, and presumptively, if they fail to agree, the state will impose it. And it limits the number of outlets. It requires that each of them qualify, and it requires that they be subject to continuing regulation and annual renewal of their licenses. A rather strict regulatory scheme of the taxing enterprise, even at the retail level.
Very well, Mr. Claiborne. Do you have anything further, General Gorton?
Mr. Chief Justice, and may it please the Court, Mr. Anderson's presentation seemed primarily devoted to the responsibility of the Indians and the limitation of what was described as a modest business, emphasizing the fact that at the present time his tribal clients limit sales to 3 cartons of cigarettes apiece, and that it was only on that basis that the district court permitted the tax. That is demonstrably not the case, as there is no limitation in the Yakima ordinances, which were upheld at exactly the same time and in the same set of cases by the district court. And as a matter of fact, there's a showing in the record of the extremely long distances which people drive to purchase on the Yakima reservation, not only for their own use, but for the use of their friends and neighbors. He also seemed to say, I believe, Mr. Rehnquist, that somehow or another, that while footnote 17 in the Moe case stated that tax exemptions to Indians on reservation had only a statutory basis, that tax exemptions to non-Indians had a constitutional basis, which seems to me to be relatively inconsistent. Finally, each of my opponents here has attempted at one stage or another to avoid the logical extension of their argument in dealing with how many economic enterprises the tribe could engage in, displacing, takes state tax authority over its own residents. For example, Mr. Justice Rehnquist, when you asked Mr. Claiborne the hypothetical of the manufacturing enterprise controlled by the tribe on reservation, he said that the state could impose its use tax after its citizens had purchased those automobiles and removed them from the reservation, because you didn't include a tribal tax in your hypothetical. Clearly, his answer would have been that were there even the most modest of tribal taxes, that that enterprise, too, would be tax-free. As a matter of fact, he made that quite express when later on in his presentation he stated that in all probability this enterprise would, the state's taxes would be invalid without a tax by the Indian tribes simply because of the tribal participation in the sales. While each of these gentlemen has stated that they do not seek here to re-argue or to reverse Mull, in effect, every one of them, every one of their arguments, for all practical purposes, requires reading Roe out of the United States reports. The pure fact of the matter is that I do agree with Mr. Claiborne on one statement only, and that is, of course, that the state could have the same effect on tribal businesses simply by repealing its tax. What that shows more clearly than anything else is the fact that the state's tax system is not an interference with tribal self-government, because the effect of a state action is identical in either event. If the state has the right to make one decision, it clearly has the right to make another. Nothing in the state's program here prohibits any type of regulation of business on reservation by the Indian tribes. Nothing in our submission here prohibits them from adding markups or taxes to their tribal enterprises. We simply say that they are subject to the same economic constraints as a state is in a taxing policy. A state can certainly impose a tax which will be self-defeating because it will be so high that people will not purchase either the commodity or the commodity in a particular place. State legislatures must deal with that question every day of the week, and we simply say that tribal councils must do so too. and do not have a constitutional right, in effect, to be parasites on a state system, gaining from the state system only because of rational state decisions in connection with its own taxing authority. They do have a retained right of self-government. That right does not, however, include the right to distort a state tax system and to make it either ineffective or unjust.
General Gordon, before you sit down, do you view the issues on the motor vehicle excise taxing scheme? They're still before us, I guess.
They are.
We haven't talked about them very much this morning, but are they essentially the same as the other?
They are essentially the same. The question in the motor vehicle excise tax is simply the incidence of the tax. The Montana tax, which you voided in Moe, was clearly a property tax imposed on the reservation. The state tax in this case is a pure use tax, which applies when the automobile is used off of the reservation in the state of Washington. Our tax could not be applied to on-reservation uses of an automobile exclusively. If they stay on the reservation all year...
It's not the typical use tax that's paid on one-time tax in connection with the transaction. Isn't this an annual
tax? No. This is an annual tax.
And its economic incidence, I take it is precisely the same as a personal property tax. It's based on the percentage of the fair market value of the vehicle rather than so
correct.
Much on the horsepower or anything like that.
That is correct, but it is expressly, and in our state always has been, this wasn't a recent amendment, it is expressly a tax on the right to use an automobile on the roads of the state of Washington.
Is that the same way in which the tax which is collected from non-Indians on the motor vehicles is characterized?
Yes.
It is.
Thank you, gentlemen. The case is submitted. We'll hear arguments next in...